to the fourth case, Terry versus Richardson. Ms. Welch, welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Ms. Richardson, who is a child protection investigator for DCFS. Your Honor, if the police come to search or ask to search your bags, you have the right to refuse. This is what the United States Supreme Court said just last year in Drayton. If a child protection investigator comes and tries to remove a child from your home, you have the right to refuse. This is what this court said in Ellis. So that when Ms. Richardson instructed the plaintiff over the phone to not have contact with the child he was accused of abusing, he had the right to refuse. But Mr. Terry didn't refuse. He said, okay, or I understand. Now, when he did that, as a matter of law, his consent was voluntary. And because his consent was voluntary, as a matter of law, this case should never have gone to the jury. And in addition, because as a matter of law, Jada's custodial mother agreed to any deprivation that might have occurred here, her consent also, as a matter of law, means that Ms. Richardson was entitled to judgment on Jada's claims. Even if this court decided that the consent question didn't entitle Ms. Richardson to judgment and decided that the merits had to be reached on the verdict, perhaps the first thing I would say is this is not Brokaw. In Brokaw, as I'm sure the court knows, defendants who were various people from child welfare and the state agents came to a house in the middle of the night, kidnapped a child, and did so because, in a conspiracy, alleged conspiracy anyway, because they wanted to separate the parents and because they disagreed with the parents' religious beliefs. This is not Brokaw. Substantive due process is only for the most egregious conduct that shocks the conscience. This is what Brokaw is about. You have to balance the parents' interests here, not custodial, just visitation, and visitation only biweekly, which means the visitation wasn't to occur again until the middle of the month. And you have to balance that against the compelling state interest and also Jada's mother's interest and Jada's interest in preventing further abuse. Now, the court has said that when you look at substantive due process in the child investigation, child welfare context, there's a continuum. Investigations are not even a deprivation. No matter, they're intrusive, God knows, but their intrusiveness does not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. There is no deprivation that shocks the conscience. At the other end, again, you have Brokaw, kidnapping a child in the middle of the night in a conspiracy when you know that there's no basis for doing so. Now, the question is then, where does Ms. Richardson's instruction, and again, I searched the record last night trying to find any descriptive term that Mr. Terry used for what Ms. Richardson said to him, and the best I could find was that these were her instructions. There's no evidence in the record that she used an authoritative voice, that she threatened to terminate his parental rights if he didn't agree to no contact. All she did was say to him, stop contact, stop visitation until the investigation is over. That's it. Now, where does that fall on the continuum? Is that a kidnapping? Well, surely not. What does it, is it close, it's, where does it fall close, it falls closer to the investigation? In my opinion, it falls below an investigation in terms of intrusiveness. So, there, and then you have to look at, even if I'm wrong about that, even if this was a deprivation in the constitutional sense, even if it rose above an investigation, then you have to see, and if, there, you have to apply the same test that you apply to the removal of a child from a custodial parent to asking a non-custodial parent who has been accused, apparently, by the child to forego visitation until this is cleared up. if the same test you need for removal applies to this sort of instruction, the definite and articulable evidence leading to reasonable suspicion test, that test was met here.
Did she have the authority to say what she said?
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, you have the authority to say anything. I mean, the question is, I mean, you can say not to
no,
have...
You do? You have the authority to say anything?
That was hyperbole.
She's a government officer. You're acting in an official capacity. Right?
I apologize, Your Honor. That was hyperbole. What I should have said was that she certainly had the authority to request that a suspected child abuser not have contact with the child.
Our colloquy, though, a moment in my preparation of this case, after I had read your brief, and frankly thought it was a pretty convincing brief, put it down, thought about it for a little while, and I said, you know what this social services officer did? She rolled this guy.
She
rolled this guy. She pushed him. She used her authority to push this guy a lot further than she had a right to push him. Isn't this case at bottom really an abuse of authority case?
No, Your Honor, I think not. If you look at, for example, if you look at Drayton, I think that that's perhaps the best, most recent Supreme Court decision on this. And what Drayton says is that you have consent unless you can show, unless there's some evidence of even an authoritative voice brandishing a weapon, some kind of, I mean, what I think would have to have happened here is that to be an abuse of power, as you're implying, would be that if for example, Ms. Richardson had said, look, I'm telling you, if you have contact with your child, I'm going to make sure your rights are terminated. That might have been an abuse of power. But
there she's saying she's going to go to somebody else.
Right.
And make a case. I mean,
right.
Here, she took the position that she had the authority to keep him away from that child.
She had the authority to tell him. He had the authority to refuse. This is what Ellis says. When the child welfare people come to your door and they say, I'm taking your child, if you don't exert your right to refuse, you don't have a claim. You have a duty, because you have the right to refuse, you have the duty to exert it if you're going to then bring a constitutional claim. I mean, in Ellis, as the court will remember, the child welfare people came to the door, said, we're taking the kids, they took the kids, and the grandparents didn't do anything. And this court said in Ellis, you had the duty to object, and if you didn't object, you don't have the right now to claim a due process violation. You consented, and absent evidence of something more.
Let me ask you this. Do you think the fact that Terry waited more than 2 weeks to meet with Richardson might have some bearing on, although it might be circumstantial, whether or not he consented or he protested? 2 weeks before he even contacted Richardson?
Right. Well, what happened was when Ms. Richardson had her first phone conversation with Mr. Terry and said, you know, I can't talk to you about this over the phone in particular, he said, I understand. And he said, but I'm busy until the 9th. I'm too busy to talk about what you're asking me to do. He got himself a lawyer, and then he was able to talk with her by the 16th. Now, what happened in between those two events is really critical in terms of the investigation. Now, again, you have to remember, this started with a hotline report from a custodial parent. This isn't like the six-fold hearsay anonymous tip that has come up in other cases. It's not even anonymous. It's the custodial parent saying, my child has said that her father has engaged in oral, anal, and vaginal sex. Now, with a four-year-old, now, and then the next day, Ms. Richardson does a follow-up call. You know, check this out. Is this person crazy? Is this like Wallace, where there was the mental patient who had raised these allegations of satanic sacrifice? No. This is Ms. Richelle saying, corroborating what was in the hotline report and also giving additional details from her personal knowledge. Plaintiff shares a bed with Jada. Plaintiff's parents are out of town and Jada's bedwetting and other symptoms are worse. And also that Jada's fearing all men. Now, these are certainly the kinds of red flags that any self-respecting child protection investigator is going to say, whoa, you know, if plaintiff had been the custodial parent, I'm not sure it wouldn't have been proper to remove Jada from his custody. Now and again, and then also they, you know, Ms. Richardson goes to the home to investigate, check for the appropriateness of the home environment, follows up on these sorts of things. Then she has the next day. She has a conversation with the pediatrician. What does the pediatrician say? Pain in the fourchette area, hymen scarring, anal dilation, or lax anus. I mean, again, this kind of medical evidence is perhaps the biggest red flag you can have, as even Dr. Doyle said, for child abuse. And remember, the only person Jada ever accused of child abuse was her of sexual abuse was her father. And remember also that this plus Dr. Savings' examination, which said again, you know, fourchette scarring, extremely remarkable anal dilation, which goes along with the reports of child of anal penetration, that this kind of evidence was enough to support the indicated finding of abuse against Mr. Terry, and that finding has never been expunged. So given this evidence, there was surely definite and articulable evidence to support a reasonable suspicion that the child had been abused. In fact, the court later, when Mr. Terry was awarded visitation again, said the medical evidence was conclusive of abuse. And again, there's evidence only that Mr. Terry was the only person ever abused, and the indicated report was never expunged. Given those facts, this evidence was obviously sufficiently definite and articulable, not just a hunch, not just anonymous hearsay, to support the instruction to not have contact with the child. Now, with regard to the due process violation, you look at the Matthews test, balancing the interest. Again, his next visitation, he had biweekly visitation. He had just had it. There's 2 weeks there before he was going to be deprived of any visitation, if indeed this was a deprivation. And so he had been spoken to on the phone. He had been given some detail over the phone that there were sexual abuse investigations. And 3 days after the first day he could have exercised visitation, he had his in-person interview. At that point, he was told specific allegations. He denied them. He said, no, she's never touched my penis. She's never seen my penis. I've never done these things. And so he had noticed, and he had some kind of hearing, which is really all that is required. And again, there were plenty of procedural avenues available to him. Mr. Terry could have gone into court and said, I want a quo warranto action. How on earth can you, what right do you have to tell me I can't see my child? He could have gone in for injunctive relief. He could have gone in for declaratory relief. He didn't do any of these things. Now, in some cases, perhaps, when the state has an arcane administrative proceeding, like the Memphis Electric case, then it has to tell you about it. But when these are available, and remember, Mr. Terry had an attorney. He had an attorney. So this isn't like Duquesne, where the children were taken for 27 months. And, you know, and the woman didn't have an attorney. She was, in fact, hospitalized. Mr. Terry had an attorney then who was able to have helped him and who stood by. Now, even if there was a violation, deprivation, even if one could say that the reasonable suspicion test applies here, you can't say that there was fair warning about this. This is the kind of case in which there was law about terminating parents' rights, there was law about removing children, but there was no law about just oral instructions, and there was certainly no law that the child of a whose custodial parent agrees would be able to bring a constitutional claim. If there are no further questions, I need to revert. Thank you.
Mr. Gilbert?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jeffrey Gilbert. I represent the Terrys along with Diane Redleaf, Robert Lair, and Richard Spiegel. The jury was asked to decide two claims. First, a substantive due process claim that asked whether Defendant Richardson had definite and articulable evidence giving rise to a reasonable suspicion that John Terry had abused his daughter, Janet. The second was a procedural due process claim that asked whether Richardson had afforded John and Jade a notice and an opportunity to be heard as to whether their relationship should have been severed. Judge Mimma denied defendant's motion for summary judgment on the substantive due process claim. Magistrate Judge Gorman denied summary judgment motions on both the substantive and the procedural due process claims, and he denied motions for directed verdict and JNOV. The jury returned a verdict for plaintiffs without being asked to articulate whether it was ruling on the substance or the procedural due process claim or on both. And that's very important, because if there's a basis for affirming either of those decisions, there having been no request of the jury as to how they were ruling, the court would then affirm. To a large extent, as we heard again this morning, Richardson appeal quarrels with the jury's verdict. Whatever value such arguments had when they were made to the jury, they have little or no potency now in view of the standard of review of jury verdicts. For instance, she asked you this morning to hold as a matter of law that John Terry had consented to not see his daughter. But the question of consent is not a legal question. It's a factual question. There was a jury instruction given to the jury about consent, one that the defendants had asked for. This case actually is like Drayton only in ways that would support us. In Drayton, the district court had found that the individuals in that case had not been coerced to allow the search. They'd been asked by the police officers, may we please look in your bags, I believe it was, and they allowed them to do so. The Court of Appeals reversed, saying as a matter of law, there has to be an instruction that the person has a right to refuse that. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's just part of the factual evidence that goes to the fact finder to decide whether there was coercion or not, and they affirmed the fact finder's decision there. There's no indication that they wouldn't have affirmed the contrary fact finding in that very same case. And of course, that's all we have here. The jury decided that Mr. Terry was coerced, he was ruled, and in that respect, he was not consenting to allow for this. He was doing what he'd been told to do. And I want to emphasize that the jury had the availability of Ms. Richardson's own notes on virtually all of the case. But on this point in particular, she said in her own notes on May 1st, no visitation until report completed. That's the message she left on Mr. Terry's answering machine. She didn't say, would you please agree not to see your daughter until the investigation is completed. She said, no visitation until report completed. The next day, she was said, and I'm quoting, he was advised no contact with Jada. We didn't want any contact. Again, she didn't say that we asked him whether he would agree not to have any further contact. By the way, his next scheduled visit was not 2 weeks later. It was on her birthday, which I believe was early in May. I believe it was May 1st, but I could be wrong about whether it was the 1st or 2nd. It was that weekend that he didn't get to see her on her birthday. That was when they first stopped him from seeing his daughter, and for his knowledge at that point, it was indefinite. He had no idea when he was going to be able to see his daughter, nor, of course, did Jada. She was only 4. She had no idea when she'd be able to see her father.
Well, did Rochelle have the authority to consent on the child's behalf to the interruption of visitation?
I don't think there's any indication in the law or the facts. Nothing's been argued that she did. She was an interested party. She was beginning a relationship with a new man who she later married. By the way, Jada and Rochelle herself identified that man, Craig Perry, as the person that Jada was afraid of. So there certainly was another man who there was indication that Jada was afraid of. And that man lived with her 24 hours a day.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any pre-1995 case in the context of child abuse allegations that says that reasonable suspicion or a pre- or immediate post-deprivation hearing is required when the state interferes with custody or visitation, even temporarily? Because this was not a permanent, this was temporary.
Well, as it ended up, it wasn't permanent, but it certainly could have been at the time. John Terry had no reason to say. Yes.
Well, certainly in that phone, in the message that was left, there was no mention, even if we assume the evidence in the light most favorable to your client and look at the jury's verdict, that she said this was permanent.
No, she didn't say that. That's certainly right, Your Honor. You have to put together a couple of strands of cases, Your Honor, and I would emphasize that qualified immunity doesn't require that there be one case if you can see
no.
two cases. That,
well,
okay.
Yes, if the two cases are clear enough.
Yes. The Supreme Court, in three cases, took up the question of non-custodial parents. Armstrong versus Manzo, Stanley versus Illinois, and Santowski versus Kramer. All three of those cases concern non-custodial parents. And all three of them said that the non-custodial parents had rights to due process, that they couldn't be deprived unless there was a substantive basis for doing so, and that there had to be the requisite procedural protection. Those cases were then cited in numerous cases. This court's decision in Brokaw, that case, of course, was after 1995, but it concerned facts that had occurred in 1983, and this court said there wasn't qualified immunity because in 1983 it was clear that the law was clear that you couldn't separate a child and parents without due process.
Is the law clear that it's equal to the custodial parent?
Well, the law is, yes, I think it is clear that it's equal to the custodial parent because that's Armstrong versus Manzo, which was 1965. There, the non-custodial parent, the father, was going to lose his parental rights because of an adoption. And the court said, well, you can't do that without giving him at least the minimum requisite requirements of due process, notice, and the right to be heard. The other cases that occurred before 1995 were the various cases about the witness protection program, where the mother would remarry, go into the witness protection program with the child, and then the child would be unable to see the biological father, and those cases were all before 1965 and set as to the non-custodial father.
Do you think those fact patterns would still dictate to a reasonable officer, Ms. Gilbert, that they couldn't take the kind of action suggested here?
Yes, because there's more. Prior to 1995, the 2nd, 4th, 6th, and 8th Circuits had all held that parents accused in child abuse investigations had liberty interests protected by due process in their relationship with their children, and that therefore they were entitled to notice and hearings as to whether they should be separated. There couldn't then at that point have been any question that it applied to non-custodial parents. That was the prior Supreme Court ruling that all of these cases were based on, nor that it applied in child abuse investigations, because that's exactly what these cases were. Indeed, in 1987, this court had decided Darrell H. versus Kohler. There, the question was whether there had to be requisite evidence sufficient to reach a reasonable suspicion that the parent had abused before you could command that there be a medical examination. And this court said yes, that there was. A very similar case. That leads us, of course, to Brokaw, the case that was decided after 1995. But that concerned facts that were in 1983 and a holding from this court that there was no qualified immunity as to either a substantive or a procedural due process claim. And Brokaw has counterparts in the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 8th, and 9th circuits. All have decided cases on facts that occurred before 1995, and those courts have agreed with Brokaw, although many of them were decided before Brokaw, so there's no express agreement, but they came to the same resolution that the law was sufficiently clear before 1995 that this couldn't be done.
Mr. Terry's position is he was told not to have contact.
That's
not,
exactly.
Not advised, is that understandable? And the position, of course, of the officer is that she advised. Is that it?
Yes, and this was a substantial part of the debate that went to precisely to the jury. the defendants argued that they had just advised him of that fact and that he should have understood that he had the right to refuse. He testified, that wasn't what I understood from those phone messages. I understood that I was being told I couldn't see them, and we emphasized the same note.
How was the jury instructed on?
They were instructed with an instruction tendered by the defendant about whether or not Mr. Terry had been coerced or had voluntarily agreed to this. And the jury was told that it was our burden to show that the circumstances were coercive. That is the plaintiff's burden to show that the circumstances were coercive. And then the jury, of course, returned a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs. We argued, Mr. Terry told you that he understood it as a command. Her own notes suggest exactly that, the notes I just read to you, which of course didn't ask him, would you please agree not to see your child? They said, we don't want you to see your child. Don't see her. Right? So I think it's really clear in the record, while of course another fact finder might have reached a different conclusion, that these fact finders had every basis for reaching the conclusion that they did.
As I understand the record, Ms. Richardson went to the Illinois State Police and said she was going to establish a, quote, no-contact plan, unquote. Is this something provided for by regulation?
Yes, Your Honor. It's I believe, yes, there's a whole set of regulations providing for what are called safety plans. Safety plans can take many different forms. Mm-hmm. But one of them is what is typically called a no-contact plan, Your Honor, which is simply that.
Tell me about how does that come to be?
The Department of Children and Family Services has promulgated the regulations for safety plans. This is actually the subject of other litigation, which is pending in the district court now. They assert the authority to have any number of forms of what they call safety plans. They can take the form of supervised visitation. They can take the form of other sorts of instructions or...
But who has the authority to issue these?
The investigators, people like Ms. Richardson.
So that step of going to the police, is that just a notice?
Yes. The department always notifies the local police when they're investigating something that could also be charged as a crime. She did so in this case, and she indicated that she was issuing this no-contact plan, I think just to put the police officer on notice that he didn't need to do so as well, that
now,
step had already been handled.
Was outside of these communications with your client, was anything else done to issue a no-contact plan, or is that the no-contact plan?
She recorded it in her notes. That's really all that was done.
Is that all the regulations require?
Yes, Your Honor, that's all the regulations require. There is no process for contesting a no-contact plan or any other safety plan. There's no available procedure to take this to anybody other than her for review.
Now, the original, there was a custody decree in effect.
Yes.
Was that because of matrimonial proceedings and a divorce, is that right?
Yes, that was actually a settlement agreement, of course, entered by the
DCFS divorce. Has DCFS been involved at all in that?
No, Your Honor, that was
just a divorce. This was the first contact that your client had with DCFS?
Yes, Your Honor, he testified that he'd never had anything to do with DCFS before.
I see.
There was then subsequently a action brought by Rochelle, Jada's mother, under the Illinois Domestic Violence Act, seeking relief. There was never in that action any order entered that John could not visit with Jada. There was an order entered that he couldn't deprive Rochelle of her custodial rights and that he couldn't stalk her.
I'm sorry, this was entered by whom?
By the circuit court of the local county.
And when had that been issued?
That came on after. Many weeks, six weeks after. But I want to emphasize, the Department of Children and Family Service were not involved in that proceeding. They could not have been. There's no statutory authority for joining them.
Do DCFS regs require or permit someone who is the subject of a no-contact plan to contest it in any way?
To contest it in any way?
Yes.
No. There is no forum in which it can be contested.
And what is the what teeth is there to it then?
Well, as a practical matter, I don't know what teeth there might be. That is, had a person like John Terry simply had said, I'm not going to do this, I'm not sure what else they could have done. But he testified that he felt compelled by the instruction of a state officer to do what he'd been told. Not unlike the McNair case, Your Honor, where this court said, when the police tell you to pull over, you pull over. You don't pick the place where you'd like to pull over or decide whether you think it's a good idea. He did what he was told by a state officer. Now, I think the state might have difficulty enforcing these safety plans if somebody simply said, no, I won't do it. But that doesn't mean that when they tell somebody to do it and he agrees to the state authority, that he's not being coerced to give up his rights. We cited a number of cases.
Ms. Gilbert, as to Ms. Richardson's conduct in response to any, quote, safety plan, which I guess was in existence at the time, are there guidelines under what triggers an officer such as Richardson to act under a safety plan?
Yes, Your Honor. We could gladly send you the cite on this. Part of the Administrative Code of Illinois.
Is that in any way the body of law she was operating on?
Yes, I think it certainly was the body of law.
Is it clear that the case law trumps the inappropriateness? Let's assume that she acted inappropriately.
Yes, I would say.
Would you say that the case law is so clear that operating under a contemporary reg of her department, she should have known that she could not have triggered the plan?
Yes, I think it's any of innumerable cases we could cite that the Constitution under the Supremacy Clause trumps.
Well, I understand that. I just wonder on qualified immunity if that's quite the inquiry. I appreciate that, but and you're clearly right as a general proposition. But I'm just wondering, as a reasonable state actor, whether she should have been aware that that did not empower her, because it would be contrary to the state of the law for familial relations.
Well, actually, we never argued that she had no authority to do this at all. We said her authority depends on whether or not she's got the requisite evidence to draw the reasonable suspicion with regard to Mr. Terry and whether she affords him an opportunity to be heard. I think the case law that I've cited to you, all of which are cases where, or many of which are cases in which child welfare officials come in and separate a parent and child, which are in effect safety plans
but they may be more unofficial safety plans. I mean, they may be in the general perceived discretion as the officer sees it, as opposed to, I'm just wondering whether this has any stand apart status because it has this command of sorts from an operating reg. That's all.
I don't think so, because it's exactly the same conduct. It's separating the parent and child without proceeding.
Well, I understand the bottom line aspect.
Right.
I
don't see how a reasonable official could have read those cases and thought that they could go about this without first having an evidentiary basis for a reasonable suspicion. That's exactly what the cases say, and without affording some hearing.
Most of those cases, were those permanent removals or temporary?
I think many of those cases were permanent removals,
right.
But I would emphasize that they're based upon this body of case law from the Supreme Court that concern non-custodial parents, and so those are necessarily going. And in fact, in Stanley versus Illinois, the defense made the argument there, and the court responds to it expressly in the decision, saying there was an opportunity for the biological father, he was an unwed father in that case, to seek a petition, to file a petition with the state seeking to become the adoptive parent. And the court expressly said the fact that there might be some way to remedy this later on doesn't mean that it isn't a wrong when it occurs. And so I think that case also stands for the problem.
But in your mind, whether it's temporary or permanent, the same standard should apply.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would emphasize in this case that it became temporary, as it turned out, later on. But neither John nor certainly Jada had any basis for understanding that it was temporary when it was imposed.
Didn't she say that it was until the report was concluded or the investigation was concluded?
Yes, but then what she did is she found against him. And he testified that his understanding was that when the report concluded against me, I wasn't now free to see my child because I'd been found to have been somehow guilty for this. It was only later on in the proceedings that Rochelle Terry had brought, when the judge there found, as a matter of fact, that John had not abused his daughter, that John again felt empowered to go ahead and see Jada. And
Mr. Gilbert, was there any judicial recourse for your client?
I don't...
Have you gone to some state court and had that order stayed or...
Well, he could have brought a 1983 action, I suppose. Of course, that's ultimately what he did. That's this action.
You know, is there an would Illinois state law provide him with an avenue to, if he really thought this was an abuse of power by the officer?
No, I don't believe so. The Richardson cites the Illinois Domestic Violence Act and the Juvenile Court Act, I believe. Well, the Domestic Violence Act only allows people who were involved in a domestic situation to protect themselves from the other person involved in the domestic. There's no authority for bringing a state agency in. And the Juvenile Court Act can only be brought by the state itself against the parent seeking some sort of relief because the parent is accused of being abusive. There's no authority for the parent to turn around and sue the department in that proceeding.
These regulations, do they, as a threshold for issuing a no-contact order, how specific are they? Do they tell the officer what kind of evidence he or she needs? Anything of that nature?
I looked to counsel who's more familiar with the regulations than I, but I thought the answer was no, and she assured me by a head shake that she believes the answer is no, too. Obviously, I don't have them in front of me, but as I said, I'd be glad to just send a letter identifying them for the court, even in closing them, if you'd like us to. That's perfectly...
You may do that within 7 days' copy, obviously.
Fine.
Ms. Gilbert.
We will.
Ms. Welch.
If there are no further questions, I know my time is
up. All right. Thank you. And do you have anything?
No.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Ms. Welch?
So why don't you begin on that note?
No. Sorry?
Could he sue after getting this ruling, this adverse ruling? Where could he sue? In the state court? How could he get reviewed?
Adverse ruling?
Yes. In terms of the visitation with the daughter. You know, there was the no consent. Let me make sure I got the sequence right. The no contact plan, and then she makes the final determination.
The indicated finding.
Right.
Yeah, that's administrative review. That's very straightforward. You go in, you have a hearing, you ask to have the indicated finding expunged, and it's expunged. Mr. Terry started the proceeding and then didn't follow up, so the indicated finding remains non-expunged.
Well, what does the what just having the indicated finding, what prohibition does that place him under? What happens if the indicated finding indicates someone has done things he shouldn't have done?
They're placed on the state registry, the central registry, and the fact that there is this indicated finding against him that of sexual abuse, the three charges, penetration, molestation, yeah. So that's there. But I have to say, I mean, counsel is just incorrect in saying that there is no state remedy. I mean, as we said, there was quo warranto, for example. They could have said, he could have gone in on a quo warranto and said, by what right, Ms. Richardson, do you have to tell me I can't have contact with my child? But again, as counsel conceded, it wasn't enforceable. What could Ms. Richardson have done if he decided to have contact? And in fact, he wanted to have contact with his child the next day, and it was only because Rochelle deferred him that he didn't have contact with her. Rochelle told him that Jada was sick. And so that's why he didn't have contact with Jada the next day. So the notion that Mr. Terry believed that this was some kind of bar to his contact is just not possible, given that he was ready to have contact the next day.
Upon receiving the initial contact order, he was of the view that this was just crazy, and he wanted to do something to just make it clear he could see his daughter. Did he have any court he could have gone to?
Yes, he could have gone to the Illinois State Court and sued her in quo warranto, sued her for declaratory relief, sued her for injunctive relief, or he could have just told her, wait a second, how come you're telling me this? You don't have any right. This is what the Supreme Court said people have to do in Drayton. This is what this court said in Ellis. You have to question whether people have the right to do it. Now, in certain cases, if somebody has a search warrant, then they have a show of authority. And so you don't, you know, so you, there's no point in questioning it. When the blue lights are flashing, that's a show of authority. You can't question that. But when someone says to you, I want to search your stuff, you can't leave, you can't have contact, unless there's something else going on, you have the right to just say no. And if you have the right to just say no, you have to exert it. Now, the testimony also, counsel suggested that this was not this kind of no contact thing. There was nothing in the record about this. Well, in fact, I believe the assistant director of DCFS testified that this was the policy in every child abuse investigation is when somebody is accused of child abuse, the first thing you do is make sure that the child is safe. And what you do to make a child safe when they've been accused of being sexually abused by their non-custodial father is make sure that there's no contact. You either do that voluntarily or you do it with a court order. And when Mr. Terry said, okay, what was Ms. Richardson to understand? Now, Mr. Terry was mistaken about his right to say no. Mr. Terry thought, only from TV, not from anything she said, the only evidence he said as to the source of his understanding was that he had seen TV shows that made him think that if he refused, his rights could be terminated. That's it. Nothing Ms. Richardson do. And we have to separate here between questions of law and questions of fact. Juries don't decide substantive constitutional law. Juries decide historical facts. And whether consent is voluntary is a question of law. It's not a question of fact. This is why there are suppression hearings. These are questions of law. Similarly, whether there's reasonable suspicion, it's like probable cause. These are questions of law. What would a reasonable officer think faced with this evidence?
Finish your thought. I had a question.
Faced with the evidence that I went through, it's, you know, the report, not anonymous, the corroboration, the details, you know, plaintiff sleeps with the child, the grandparents are gone, the symptoms are worse. I mean, this is the kind of evidence that certainly creates reasonable suspicion, if not probable cause. Sorry.
Yeah, I just when the investigation was concluded, which was June 16th, and she made the finding that abuse was indicated, Rochelle sought a protective order, and the court entered a temporary order prohibiting John from removing. Was the temporary visitation issue discussed during that?
I'm sorry?
Was the temporary visitation his right to visit?
Discussed during the DV?
Yes.
Your Honor, it's not in the record. I don't really know. But what I do know is that before...
So that would have been an opportunity for him to raise it. I understand that she's the one that filed it. I understand
right.
that.
Right. Well, the first hearing, remember, was ex parte. So he wasn't there. But for the second one, and he signed it, remember. I mean, this was an agreed protective order. And he apparently didn't see fit to request supervised visitation. And also, let's remember that before that order was in existence, there was a custody order that gave the plaintiff the absolute right to visitation. Now, all he had to do was say to Ms. Richardson, hello, here's my custody order. I have an absolute court-ordered right to visitation. And until you get your own court order, I'm going with this. And he didn't do that. What he said was, okay, I understand. Now, if I can just, I know my time's up, but I noticed that there was a lot of overtime.
Yeah, no, I gave Ms. Gilbert some more time. Obviously, you may have some more time.
A couple of things, though. We objected to the consent. And in fact, that's one of the consent jury instruction. That's one of the reasons that we asked for a new trial here, because the consent instruction was wrong. The consent instruction doesn't say the plaintiff has the duty to prove this. What the consent instruction says is the defendant claims John Terry waived his constitutional rights. So that meant, obviously, we had to prove it because we were claiming it. And also, when it says what the plaintiff had to prove, it doesn't say he had to prove consent. It just says plaintiffs have the burden of proving intentional interference, without describing it, by the way, with failed to act or acted, damage, and injury, proximate cause. That's it. In addition, the council talked about the long-standing law about due process rights for non-custodial parents. Well, that's true. There's plenty of law that explains that before you terminate or remove a child or take a child into witness protection and sever the relationship between a parent and a non-custodial child, yeah, of course you have to have a hearing. I mean, there's no question about that. But here, the question is whether in this kind of case, when all you're doing is giving someone an instruction that is counsel apparently concedes is not enforceable, whether you have to have notice in a hearing before or after. You don't. I mean, it just doesn't make sense that you would have to have a hearing before you just tell somebody something. Would there have to be a hearing before in Drayton the police asked the guy to open his bag? I mean, this kind of action doesn't require notice and opportunity to be heard. It's not severance. It's not termination.
I'm going to have to ask you to.
I'm going to right. Just again, if I can just sum up.
Okay.
Okay. One sentence. This is child welfare. Action first, hearing after. There is nothing conscience-shocking about asking a non-custodial parent to forgo visitation when he's been accused of abusing his child. And certainly, Ms. Richardson was not on notice that she couldn't do it.
One last question, just a factual question. Was the May 1st call preserved?
I'm sorry?
The message was that preserved and entered, or is that just a recollection that was testified to? I mean, obviously left on a recording machine on the screen.
Right. I think both the plaintiff and both Mr. Terry and Ms. Richardson testified that there was a message left on the machine.
Yeah, I'm asking, did the jury hear the message?
Oh, the message itself, not, no.
So they just testified
about it.
The message was not preserved.
Correct.
At least for not preserved and presented for trial.
I'm sorry.
The message itself was not preserved, but Ms. Richardson noted in the investigation file what the message was. So you could read her own words, we would say, her
admission. All right. Well, we'll examine the record as always. Our thanks to all counsel. And the case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the